I must say this is a first. This is my sermon written on airplanes. And I think it's very fitting that this is my sermon because it kind of represents a kind of simplicity and immediacy that was the experience I had when I was there. So today my sermon is called Passages from India, and in fact that's just what I'm going to do, is offer some vignettes about my experience there. It's hard to explain your experience when you go to a place like India. You can talk about what you experienced and how you experienced it, but it's a very hard place to describe. So I will do my best. So passage number one, arrival. Immediately upon arriving in India, you're hit with this sort of full-on sensory experience of being somewhere different. You have this combination of haze, incessant smell of something that smells like it's burning, sweat, spices, and cow dung, in addition to other things. You're sort of assaulted by the environment because it's so different from what you're used to, and it is hot. 90 to 92 degrees every single day, even in the shade. We stay in Delhi overnight because there is only one flight to Jabalpur every day. It is not on the tourist grid. It's right in the center of the country. It's a traditional place where we wore traditional clothes, and every day we're expected to cover our neck with a scarf, a chuni worn exactly as I'm wearing this one. In fact, this one went with me, and I wore it regularly. We finally do get to the mission, and it is presided over, as I said, by Didi Ganeshwari, this person of great, incredible humor, warmth, love, and political skills. She was quite a combination. And everybody greets one another there with their hands pressed together and says, Jevarat, Jevarat, which means honor all beings, or literally victory to all living things. And after you've had Jevarat said to you by 500 beautiful, not 500, but hundreds of beautiful little glowing faces every day at the school, it sort of banishes any negative thought you could ever have. I feel myself coming back to life in a new sort of way after a couple of days, but it's sort of slow because I really am coming out of this very different rhythm and environment into something very new. But I make a commitment to be patient with myself and write in my journal every day, and I do in fact do that, in fact exceeding greatly my expectations of my writing every day and what that would bring me, and of course the meditation practice in the garden. Life is very simple, but it's enriched in a special kind of way. A bath is taken with a large bucket and a small scoop if the water is hot. And if the water isn't hot, you heat the water and you stand in the bathroom and you bathe yourself, and the water flows into a little drain in the corner, and then you squeegee the floor. And once I got the hang of this, it was great. By the time I left there, it seemed like the normal way to bathe oneself. Nobody complains about these things. Nobody says, the water isn't hot today. What's wrong with the water? The lights went out. What's wrong with the electrical system? There is a kind of flow to life there that is very accepting. So I am overjoyed that I'm going to be living in community for 2.5 weeks, and I'm not sure quite what to expect, but community was exactly what I received in every possible way. Passage number two, sacred cows in the passing lane. Cows in India are sacred. I think we know that to some extent. They don't eat cows there. And there are thousands of stray cows wandering around in India, wherever they wish to roam, thank you very much, along with the many stray dogs. They definitely occupy the top rung in what is the most crazy traffic dance I've ever seen in my life. There are no traffic lights for the most part because it would actually muck up the works. And the pecking order is cows, cars, scooters and motorcycles, auto rickshaws, bicycles, people, and dogs. Oddly, this becomes completely normative to me after about a week. cars flying, all these various elements flying through the streets, somehow slowing down and speeding up and passing on roads that really are barely one lane, and you just stop holding your breath after a while and assume that they know what they're doing. I never saw an accident, and I never saw any road rage. Two of the people that work for the Brahma Rishi Mission, Gudu and Deepak, pretty much drove us anywhere we wanted to go. We were very sheltered and protected by the people there in the sweetest possible way. We got to know Gudu in particular extremely well and came to trust his driving, even under the most difficult circumstances. As I said, there's no road rage there because this is just the way they move around the city, and road rage really comes from anger. The idea that I deserve to be in this spot and you don't. You aren't going fast enough. This is my space. You're taking my space. The horn is a constant in traffic in India, but it isn't an angry horn honk. It's an informational horn honk. I am on the side of you. I am about to pass you. I don't want to hit you. Here I come across the road without any warning, right? Meanwhile, veering around cows, dogs, and people. You know, you figure in a country where there are 1.3 billion people, a civilization that's been around since 3200 BC, they've had to figure out some way to coexist, and traffic is the greatest metaphor for that when you go to India. Because I realize that even though the place has a caste system, and traffic has a sort of caste system, that you realize that even if even one person in this scenario thought that they were more important than the next, the whole thing would fall apart and you would have gridlock and crack-ups every 3 feet. So I took away from this idea of a kind of harmony in which we don't think that we're more important than the next person, and that everyone deserves to take up a little space on the road. I was thinking about one person in particular who, after 2 minutes of this madness, would have literally had a cow. Passage number 3. Birthday bash in the Chakra Ballroom. After a day with the students, teaching them English, or at least attempting to teach them English, which turned out to be far more challenging than I expected, but enormously satisfying nonetheless. Lisa and I went with Didi and Maitreya, who was another younger Swami at the mission, to a very grand rich people's birthday party at one of the only really grand hotels in Jabalpur. It was held in the Chakra Ballroom, which made me laugh because it was like, seemed like an oxymoron to me. But the contrast was like a cold slap between the simplicity of the mission and the opulence of this ballroom and this party. And we had spent part of the day on this boat ride at a place called Marble Rocks, and the boat was looked like it had been welded back together about 100 times. So I'm looking around with all these people in their silks and their jewels, this huge buffet of food, and I feel contempt. And I ask myself, when did I become such a snob about rich people? I realized that this party, coming only a few days into my time there, that this shindig would have fed thousands of everyday Indians who live the most hardscrabble poverty you've ever seen in a normalized way. It would have fed them a simple meal, the kind of meal they eat, something like dal and chapati. So I mentioned this to Lisa when we get back, and she very blasely and objectively says, it's all part of the picture. Those are the people who support the school and the hospice and all the other charities in Jabalpur. You have to have people with money to support these causes. I thought she's right about that, because I got to know some of those people during my trip and their devotion to the school and the hospice and other things in the city was admirable. But a light bulb went off over my head about this, And I thought, it's always worked this way, hasn't it? Since ancient times, we've always had class. We've always had some form of caste systems. They've taken hold in our cultures. And I come back vowing to want to find out more about how that happened and when that happened and how that can be transformed, if that can be transformed, or if instead it's like the traffic metaphor where these pieces fit together in a certain way. Passage number 4. Danyavad. Oops, never mind. Indu, Gudu, Bai, Krishna, and so many others that worked at the mission, worked at the school and at the hospice. They cooked our meals. They drove us around. They generally cared for us in simple ways. They were servants. I even hate saying the word. But they were servants who were so much a part of a family-like structure. I saw them somewhat differently, and I had discomfort from my Western perspective, sort of my perhaps overly woke lens about the whole thing. There was so much mutuality and respect among the people, regardless of all of this, and no weirdness about it at all. Indu, who was like the radar O'Reilly of the place, Dee Dee was constantly calling his name, Indu, Indu this, Indu that. And he really, I cried when I said goodbye to him. He was so endearing and wonderful. But the ease and the readiness between the two of them was beautiful to see. Indu came to live at the school and went to the school from an early age and ended up staying there to work there. And there's just deep love and respect. His new bride, Archana, also is now at the school. She's studying to be a medical assistant. She's going to work at the hospice. They're from the same village, about an hour away from Jabalpur. And it was an arranged marriage. Arranged marriage is still very common at all levels of society in India. And she was very lovely. So the word for thank you in Hindi is danyavad. It was one of the words I learned first because I wanted to be able to say it. And then I was told I shouldn't say it. I shouldn't say it to the people who worked at the mission. It's like, quit saying thank you. I don't know how to stop saying thank you. Thank you is what you say when someone makes you a meal or drives you somewhere or does something nice for you. You say thank you. And Lisa explained to me that every time I said thank you, I created distance between me and them, and that what they were doing for me was what was expected of them in a beautiful harmony, and that I was creating formality and distance, and they weren't. And I thought about that, that here I was thinking that I was doing something that was showing respect for them as the serving class of the place, and in fact, what I was doing was creating distance and formality. So over time, I was able to move from saying danyavad to just smiling and showing appreciation, or saying svadish, which means delicious. So I would compliment the food rather than thank them for their service. I think the gratitude was so evident, and just the feeling of gratitude for the space was so lovely and so natural. Danyavad did not need to be said. Passage number 5. I'm dreaming of an orange Diwali. I didn't realize Diwali was going to feel so much like a Christmas kind of feeling, but it did, the way people prepared. It was sort of funny. There was like crazy last-minute shopping the day before Diwali, and the city became even more intensely charged. And a lot of it is buying things on the street from vendors who sell specific things. I feel really lucky to have been there for Diwali and seeing that aspect of their life there and the preparations and the beautiful decorations, the Rangoli on the sidewalks, the lights everywhere. We took a day trip to Bhopal, which was, we took an overnight train to Bhopal, which an overnight Indian train, that's a whole nother story. to see this amazing Shiva temple and these painted caves. And when we came back on a day train, it was the day before Diwali, and it was packed with people going home for Diwali, just the way people go home for Christmas or Thanksgiving, with their packages and their suitcases and, you know, wrapped presents. And I really could feel this overall sense of light and the idea of welcoming light back from hovels to manor houses. One of the things that I was surprised to see was the prevalence of cell phones at everywhere, including at the mission. Both swamis had cell phones. They both have Facebook accounts. The priest who came to do puja for Diwali, and puja is this elaborate ritual ceremony of all these things that get put on altars and beads around the statues and fruit. I mean, it's very elaborate. It goes on and on and on. There's this thing and that thing and this thing and that thing. So, of course, a male priest in their tradition comes. He's wearing all white. And I noticed at one point during the puja that he's checking his text messages. And I realized that, you know, modern culture has pretty much invaded everything. But it also made me realize how I had romanticized things that I thought I would see and do when I went to India. I think I had myself, like, inside one of these pictures up here. And India is a modern place, too. Like, even in people standing outside of basically like a hole that they live in on a cell phone. And you see how technology has woven its way in. But the priest checking his text messages, I thought, really sort of took the cake. In between venerating Ganesha, he was checking to see who had texted him. So, note to self, don't romanticize and project narratives onto things you think you're going to experience. Just go and experience them. But Diwali was very joyful. And Didi surprised Lisa and I by giving us mehndi as a gift. Mehndi is henna, tattoo, it's temporary. And it was a beautiful gift for her to give each of us to do one of our hands for Diwali. Passage number 6 kind of builds on that. I call it Swami with a Killer Instinct. If you've played the board game Parcheesi, you know Parcheesi? It's like a classic, right? Then you will grasp how Ludo, the Indian version, is played on Swami Maitreya Didi's cell phone. She has Ludo on her phone. So Lisa, Maitreya, and I passed the time on the train back from Bhopal. She went with us playing Ludo on this 6-hour trip. So Maitreya, who's a Swami in orange robes, you got to picture this, has the killer instinct of a Las Vegas card sharp. She keeps sending Lisa and me back to our home base, giggling and proclaiming with glee, "Killer, oh sorry," with a twinkle in her eye. We remind her that karma is a, rhymes with witch, which is hilariously apt as we're talking about karma, because somehow she keeps almost beating us, and in the end, we keep sending her back to her home base. They really do become real people to me after first meeting them and thinking, oh, you know, they're swamis in orange robes and everything that comes out of their mouth is spiritual and everything they do is spiritual. But underneath all of that, the red robes and the foreheads with the red powder, the orange robes, are two women who were deeply loved and respected, who provided incredibly unconditional love, spirit, and community, glue, and who also watched spiritual soap operas, because we watched them with them, this one channel where the soap operas are all based on stories like Rama and Ganesha. And as I said, spent a lot of time on Facebook. So I was really pleased that these two people, who I expected to have some sort of distance from, became so real and, you know, so textured to me. And it just heightened my sense of respect for them and closeness. Passage number 7. Chitta, chitta, bang, bang. Chitta, in yogic philosophy, is one of the four aspects of consciousness, allowing our emotional reactions to experiences. This can be mind stuff, this can be heart stuff. I realize through my journal writing and lots of honest processing, sort of away from my regular life, that we actually attract what we need to grow the seed of chitta until it's time to burn the seed. That there are ways to move from pain and hot emotions to processing, to clarity, to more processing, to an almost like a neutralizing of our emotions without somehow ignoring them or not validating them. I think for me, this was the most transformative thing that happened to me on this journey, was this deeper understanding and actually experience of taking hard emotions, hard situations, chitta, and moving towards a place of greater neutralization. I wasn't expecting that, but I'm deeply grateful for it. And finally, Arti Party, which also is, I call, sitting Shiva with Shiva. So as you know, there was a shooting in Pittsburgh when I was away. It was at one of the synagogues in Squirrel Hill where I grew up. I've spent much time in that synagogue and luckily did not know anybody personally who was killed in that tragedy. But it was very hard to be away from Pittsburgh, and I even considered coming home. That's how hard it was to be so separated from a community I know and love going through something so hard. I wanted to be there with them. I felt like I was able to follow what was happening there and be brought there through various connections. And as I did that Soham meditation, that I am, that I am, that I am, it was like, yes, that I am, you know, a Jewish girl from Pittsburgh, you know, from that community, sitting Shiva with Shiva a long way from home. The day of the shooting, that night, was the first night we were taken down to the Ghat, the river, for the nightly Arti prayer ritual. And it was the first time I bought one of those small biodegradable oil lamps that's sort of made out of paper. It's filled with flowers and powder and a little oil lamp, and you set it out on the river with prayers. So I set out several of those. It's quite an elaborate ritual, and it happens every night. And hundreds of people come down to the river, not just our river, but lots of rivers. It's just what happens. And there's a swami, and there's the people on platforms, and there's candles, and there's all this stuff. And I look around, and I realize that ritual is not something that these people do. Ritual is part of who they are. It is them. It isn't what they do. It's who they are. That I am, that I am, that I am. And it just brought a whole new meaning to that ritual for me, was to see it so naturally woven into people's lives at all level of society. And I asked myself, you know, how do we in our culture, how do we in this community, this church, have ritual, worship, spirituality not be what we do, but who we are, woven more into our identity? I would say, aside from the chitta and the neutralizing, my biggest takeaway from this whole thing was love. Just love. You know, we create narratives in our life that don't support our intentions. They don't support our desire to be close to people. We crave and grasp and want a smooth, unimpeded ride on the road, but what we often get is a metaphor for the traffic in India. Auto rickshaws and stray dogs, they're not going to abate just because they annoy us and trigger our pain, guilt, loneliness, ambivalence. But really, it sounds corny, but being in this community for almost 3 weeks and seeing the way Indian people seem to be with each other, I really was brought back to the idea that we are love. essentially. And we can be love in an even greater way. We can open ourselves to the full sensory life of joy, sorrow, riches, trash strewn around us. I am game to take India more and more inward and keep dodging the sacred cows. Joy is there everywhere, Tagore tells us. Fearful joy. Jai Bharat, Shanti Om, and blessed be.